From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. With less than a week to go until the presidential election, we explore the ethics of campaign financing with Wall Street Journal reporter Brooks Jackson, author of the new book Honest Graft. Also today, I speak with science fiction writer William Gibson. His disgust with unicorn fantasies and what he calls male power science fiction led him to write what he hoped would bug other science fiction writers. The results have become known as cyberpunk. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album by a Bulgarian female vocal choir whose first album was a surprise hit here in the United States. And if you're trying to figure out how to keep the neighborhood dogs off your lawn, Urban Legends expert Jan Harald Brunvand explains how they do it in New Zealand. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. We've all been treated to a barrage of political commercials in the past few weeks. The high cost of producing and placing TV commercials is one of the reasons election campaigns are getting more and more expensive. Where campaign money comes from and what political favors are owed in return is the subject of a new book by Brooks Jackson. He's an investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal, where he covers money in politics. You can tell by the title of his new book, Honest Graft, what he thinks of the current system for regulating political donations from individuals and special interest groups. Jackson accuses the system of offering perverse incentives to legislators. Those who cater to the well-funded are rewarded. Those who challenge the status quo are punished. Brooks Jackson might not approve of the system, but he does find reporting on campaign financing a fascinating business.
Well, my fascination comes from the fact that this is part of the process. This is the what shapes the underlying what is the underlying context of our government. I think money plays an enormous role in what happens in Congress, what happens in our elections, and indirectly, therefore, what happens in the everyday lives of ordinary citizens.
Do you think that there's more pressure on political parties and political campaigners to get money than there ever used to be because finance costs have gotten so expensive?
Oh, there's absolutely no question about it. Now, there is this overwhelming appetite for money in Washington today. I have, as a reporter, covered this for many years, since before Watergate, back in the days when they used to pass cash around in brown paper bags. And after Watergate, we supposedly reformed the system and regularized political action committees, required disclosure. But in many ways, the present system is worse. It now costs about $500,000 for a House candidate to win an election where there's really any competition. That's just the average in the last election. And you have to raise that, unless you can finance it out of your own pocket, which very few people can do, in amounts of no more than $1,000. That means that a candidate for the House of Representatives, whether they're an incumbent or a challenger, has to spend enormous amounts of time raising the amount of money that's required to get through to the voters today.
Why are campaigns so much more expensive now? Is it because of media time, pollsters?
Well, some people will say it's because there's more money available and it's a matter of more available dollars simply being spent because lobbyists have so much more money to give now than they did 10 or 15 years ago that it's always going to be spent if it's available. There's something to that. But also, it is simply more expensive to run for several reasons. What we've done is to take our politics today from what used to be a labor-intensive enterprise where you had lots and lots of volunteers and there wasn't a whole lot of money spent, to a capital-intensive enterprise where one purchases television time, radio time, and the costs of that, by the way, have gone up faster than the general rate of inflation. One buys computer-driven mail, And postage becomes very expensive, sending thousands and thousands of fundraising letters or campaign flyers, consultants, polling. All the modern paraphernalia for getting elected to office today is just simply enormously expensive. And that's something you can't repeal, you can't change by law, you simply have to deal with.
So a lot of the money for the campaigns come from special interest groups, and the special interest groups get what in return for their money?
Well, that is the question that will probably be debated endlessly. I'll give you my view of it, and as one who has covered this for many years, as one who for a brief time during the 1986 elections was allowed to sit inside the Democratic Party's reelection machinery for House members and also inside the Republican Party's campaign committee. I think that special interest groups get a number of things. They get access. They get privileged access. In fact, the parties are marketing special access to their lawmakers in return for campaign contributions. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has what it calls a speaker's club, where an individual for $5,000 a year or a political action committee for $15,000 a year gets, well, they have a regular brochure that tells you what you get. You get special briefings, you get luggage tags, you get golf outings with the Speaker of the House. At least they did when Tip O'Neill was Speaker. I don't know that Jim Wright's a golfer, but I believe beyond that, beyond access, special interest groups that give money, and this is not just political action committees, by the way, this by special interest, a special interest donor can be an individual as well, and there are many Wall Street executives and tax shelter syndicators, oil men, real estate developers, all manner of people who, although they don't give through political action committees, have very special legislative interests. I believe these people are able to purchase, not votes necessarily. I have never seen very much of an outright quid pro quo, a corrupt vote-buying operation. If I could prove it, I would have probably a criminal case, not just a good news story. But what contributors buy is almost a quasi-constituent status. A donor from Arizona might, in effect, become a constituent of a senator from Michigan or a congressman from New Jersey by virtue of giving them a couple of $1,000s. And I was able to see this happening. Tony Coelho, who was chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and who, in the process of researching honest graft, I was able to engage in some remarkably candid interviews. At least they amazed me with their candor. Explained it once. He told a story, which I relate in the book, about a donor who had given. He was a member of the Speaker's Club. He'd given $5,000, and he wanted a favor. He wanted help with some petty governmental concern. Doesn't really matter what, but Tony was most anxious to help him. Sent him to one subcommittee chairman, sent him to another subcommittee chairman. The fellow came back unsatisfied and said, the way Tony Coelho told it, "I expected better treatment from this. I gave you money and I expected better treatment than this." Well, at that point, Tony Coelho said, I became indignant. I told him, your money hasn't bought you anything. I gave him his money back and threw him out of the office. Well, I thought this, he says, you know, I told him, don't ever say that your money has bought you anything. If you say it, it's all over. Now, to Congressman Coelho, he was throwing the fellow out of his office in righteous indignation. But to me, the story said something differently. He was, and I think this is a common ethical code among members of Congress. It's peculiar to an outsider, but quite common to the lawmakers. It is perfectly all right for them, in their minds, to do a favor for a campaign contributor, even though he might not be a constituent, he might not have anything to do with the interests of the congressman or senator's constituents. Perfectly all right to do favors for them. But the unforgivable thing is ever to suggest that by virtue of their money, they are entitled to those favors. A very peculiar sort of way of drawing the line.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Brooks Jackson, and he reports on campaign financing for the Wall Street Journal. That's the subject of his new book, which is called Honest Graft. Now, there are laws limiting the amount of money that any individual or any political action committee can donate to a candidate. That's called hard money. But then there's also something called soft money, and soft money is a way of circumventing the rules that exist about donations. What are some examples of how you can give money that surpasses the legal limits?
Well, soft money is basically everything but what you see disclosed at the Federal Election Commission, and everything but the money that falls strictly under the federal limits, and there's a lot of it. There are Well, both campaigns now, both presidential campaigns for Mr. Dukakis and Mr. Bush are accepting $100,000 checks from donors who are able to afford to write checks that large. They run not to the through the campaign committees of the candidates. That would be illegal. In the presidential race, they can only take public money, and that's it, and there are limits to what the campaign itself directly can spend. But the political party, whether it's the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, has numerous ways of using an individual donor's money, or for that matter, a corporation or a labor union's money, to advance the cause of their presidential candidate and all other candidates. They can, for example, use it for get-out-the-vote drives that benefit an entire ticket. There are more ways that they can get around the law than we have time to go into here, but the practical effect is, and the interesting fact is, that the limits that we thought we were enacting after Watergate back in 1974 are, for all practical purposes now, a dead letter. There are simply so many ways around them. And that's true right down to the House level, right down to the congressional candidate level. One of the examples I give in Honest Graft is that the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee was able to finance construction of an entire new television studio with soft money through what they called a building fund, which our regulators had decided, rightly or wrongly, didn't count as campaign contributions under the election law. Well, that studio then was used to churn out TV and radio commercials, which the committee gave to its candidates free of charge, and essentially turned into campaign contributions, perhaps not in a legal way, but certainly in a practical way.
You write a little bit about the techniques that politicians have for getting PACs or special interest groups to give them money. And you say that it's almost like a legal version of the old protection racket. You quote a letter that Tony Coelho, who was at the time the chairman of the Democratic Finance Committee, this was 1986 when you were researching the book, this was a letter that he sent to the National Association of Home Builders, to their PAC, and the letter said, the NAHB has a good relationship with Democrats in the House, and we would like to see that relationship continue and grow. Your action in this race causes us to be concerned that the relationship will be damaged.
Well, it's almost as though they were saying, it's a nice little trade association you've got here. Too bad if anything would happen to it. It is a little bit like the old protection racket, and it's a curious thing. Reporters like myself who cover campaign finance have been writing stories for years that I think to many people suggest that what's going on is a form of legalized bribery where special interest donors force money into the hands of candidates and trying to buy their votes. And to a certain extent, there is some of that going on. But the untold story, and I think what I try to get at in Honest Graft, is that there is a shakedown aspect to this. The candidates are quite vigorously going out seeking money from special interest donors because, by the way, our laws do encourage them to do that. They're set up in such a perverse way that you can take more money, you can take $5,000 from a political action committee that has perhaps a very narrow legislative agenda, but only $1,000 from your Aunt Minnie. It's crazy. As a result, candidates, this includes incumbents, challengers, those going in open seats, because of the enormous cost of getting elected, because of this enormous appetite that they have for money, are pursuing special interest groups, business corporations, trade associations, labor unions, ideological groups, to an extent and with a vigor that has just become unseemly.
In yesterday's Wall Street Journal, you had a front-page article on honorariums. And, you know, when I think of an honorarium, I always thought, well, you're invited to speak to a group and you give a speech and they pay you a small fee in return. But honorariums in the world of politics don't mean that anymore. What does it mean?
Well, they have undergone a change over the last 5 to 10 years. Today, an honorarium is, and I don't think I'm putting it too bluntly, for the most part, a tool for buying access, a tool that lobbyists now use for purchasing a few minutes of a lawmaker's time. I'll give you a couple of examples. There are trade associations today. The American Trucking Association is one. The Tobacco Institute is another, that have regular programs where they have breakfast maybe once every couple of weeks in a forum, a place one or two blocks away from the Capitol. And they will invite a member of Congress over to give remarks, 10, 15 minutes at the most, to answer a few questions from people. This will be a group of lobbyists from the trade association, perhaps a few executives from members of the trade association. No real preparation required, just off-the-cuff remarks and answer a few questions, and the lawmaker can walk back to his office before the first committee hearing of the day, either $1,000 or $2,000 richer. Typically, a senator gets $2,000 and a congressman gets $1,000 for one of these things, although it's getting so that even a freshman congressman can command a $2,000 fee for a very brief appearance.
So basically, you show up for a little while and you get paid.
Somehow. Well, exactly right. And there are attorneys who are becoming worried that this is so blatant today that the fee, which used to be for giving a real speech that one might even have written oneself, it's now becoming so openly just a fee for showing up and being lobbied that some a vigorous prosecutor one day might construe this as bribery and bring a case. And you know, in the story in yesterday's paper, I relate that Mr. William Weld, who came into town from Boston, where he had put an awful lot of crooked policemen and building inspectors in jail as a U.S. attorney up there, opened his paper one day, discovered that several lawmakers had been on a plane trip to Virginia, paid for by United Coal Company, and were paid about $2,000 apiece to tour coal mines down there. Well, he immediately thought he had a criminal case and was shocked to learn that this was all legal.
Apparently, in a lot of states now, candidates are using these honorarium as a weapon against their opponent. For instance, you quote a couple of ads in your article. Representative Robert Davis of Michigan, while he sat on the Armed Services Committee, was paid $17,000 in personal appearance fees by defense suppliers, and his election opponent is running a television commercial about the payment, saying what Bob Davis has done is not illegal, but does that make it right? Now that this is becoming public and opponents are accusing people who are running for election are accusing their opponents of accepting money like this in unethical ways, do you think that it might help put a stop to it?
Well, yes, I think there will be a move in Congress next year to abolish honoraria. It's becoming they're becoming such an embarrassment now that that there are a number of members who would like to get rid of them. But so many lawmakers have come to depend on these special interest fees for extra income that it's probably going to require a rather substantial pay increase to get them to go along with that. Now, the Wall Street Journal did a poll not long ago asking people who, I think about two-thirds of the people we queried said, yes, they should outlaw honoraria, but about 80% said, no, they shouldn't get a pay raise in return for doing it. But I'll tell you, these honoraria fees are, I think, the clearest and most blatant example of what I call honest graft that that you can find. It's not illegal, but that doesn't make it right.
Well, I want to talk with you about campaign financing of the current election, of the presidential election, but first we're going to take a short break. Brooks Jackson is my guest. He's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and he reports on campaign financing and the use of money by lobby groups. That's also the subject of his new book, an investigation called Honest Graft. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Wall Street Journal reporter Brooks Jackson, and we're discussing his new book, Honest Graft, which is about campaign financing and the use of money by lobby groups. Let's talk about the current campaign. Let's talk about the presidential elections. In the vice presidential debate between Benson and Quayle, the subject of Benson's Breakfast Club was raised. Give us a brief summary of what the Breakfast Club was about and where Benson stands now in campaign financing.
Well, Senator Benson, first of all, I understand, is chairman of the Finance Committee, which writes our tax laws and therefore is a real magnet for business money. Every corporation, every trade association in the country has some interest in what goes on the Finance Committee. And nobody can afford to be frozen out of the Finance Committee. Senator Benson, shortly after the 1986 elections, announced that he would institute a formal program of breakfast briefings for lobbyists who were doing business before the Finance Committee and who also agreed through their political action committees to give the maximum legal amount of money to his campaign, which is $10,000. That's $5,000 for the primary, in which he was unopposed, and $5,000, I believe he was unopposed, and $5,000 for the general. When the Washington Post got a hold of the story, and it was a wonderful scoop for them, I regret I didn't have it first myself, he said he had made a real doozy of a mistake, and he immediately disbanded the Breakfast Club, gave back the money, and washed his hands of it. Now, most all those who had given and who got their money back turned around and within a few weeks or months had still given the legal maximum, $10,000. Today, Senator Benson has exceeded all previous records for accepting political action committee money. He's up to nearly $2,500,000, I think, as of mid-October. And the curious thing is he was only building on what had happened 2 years earlier when Senator Packwood, the Republican who then headed the Finance Committee when Republicans were in control, had a breakfast club of his own. He only charged $5,000, if memory serves, and was not unduly criticized for it. Certainly didn't disband it. It was when the fee went up to $10,000 that it attracted attention.
Any major differences in fundraising style or in amount of money fundraised between the Bush-Quayle ticket and the Dukakis-Benson ticket?
Well, this is extremely difficult to get a real handle on. It appears for all practical purposes, both the Republican candidate and the Democratic candidate have plenty of money. They've got enough. They probably have more than enough. And certainly money is not going to be a factor in the outcome of the general election. Briefly, both candidates receive from the public treasury about $46 million in public funds. This is the system of public financing we enacted after Watergate, which was supposed to limit the role of private donors and end the practice of selling ambassadorships for campaign contributions and that sort of thing. Both political parties also will spend about $8 million in direct support of their candidates, mostly through buying television ads. This is what's called coordinated expenditures. It's money that's raised from private sources under federal limits and expended by the parties in direct support of their candidates. Beyond that, there's this enormous area of soft money in which both parties are vigorously pursuing large donations, small donations, anything they can get their hands on, to spend in ways that will aid the candidates indirectly, voter registration, get out the vote, generic advertising that says vote Republican or vote Democratic, that sort of thing. Nobody really knows how much, $30, $40 million more, perhaps. It's possible that the Democrats this time will actually outspend the Republicans, but because most of this money goes outside the ordinary channels where it's disclosed at the Federal Election Commission, it is not exactly given in secret, but so hard to track that you really can't say who's going to spend the most.
You've given some thought to campaign finance reform. Let's discuss some of the reforms you'd like to see put into effect. First of all, you'd like to abolish honoraria.
Well, absolutely.
And you think that's actually possible, that might actually happen in the near future. Let's move on to PACs. You'd also like to abolish PACs, political
action
committees.
Well, no. What I would suggest, and I as a reporter, I feel sometimes hesitant to suggest solutions, but I think once I've raised all these problems and said it's a terrible scandal, I feel obliged to say what I would do about it. So as a matter of, I make a few suggestions, and I hope that it gets discussion started, because discussions have been pretty much deadlocked. I think both parties are kind of locked into positions. They don't want to see any change that would give the other party an advantage. But if I were writing a campaign finance law, here's what I would do. First of all, I would prohibit political action committees from making campaign contributions to candidates. I would find another role for them. Let them go out and register voters. Let them go out and involve people in the process with their money in ways that are apart from putting money in the campaigns of candidates. I would prohibit candidates, in fact, from accepting money from any source but two. One would be their own party. I don't see any way that a political party can corrupt its own candidate, and yet we have in laws today pretty strict limits on what a party can do for its own candidates. $55,000, roughly, is about all the Democratic or Republican Party can spend directly for one of its own House candidates. That's about a tenth of what it costs. So our laws force our candidates to turn to other sources for their money. I think that's wrong. I would raise all those limits. I would do away with those limits. I would allow parties to spend unlimited amounts of money in direct support of their own candidates. And I would also prohibit candidates from accepting money, again, from anybody but their own party, or from individuals within their own state. I don't see how a New York tax shelter promoter should have a right to influence the election of a Nevada congressman or a Georgia senator, and yet that happens every day under our present system. Now, very quickly, I would subsidize the parties. I would put public money into them and find other ways of getting more money into challengers' races. We don't have, in the last election, 98% of all House incumbents were reelected. And one of the reasons that incumbents have become almost challenger-proof is that our campaign finance laws really restrict challengers from mounting effective campaigns and holding incumbents accountable. We have to change that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Brooks Jackson. He's a reporter with the Wall Street Journal and the author of the new book, Honest Graft, about campaign financing. It's published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with Julian Bond. He was a leader during the Civil Rights Movement and a member of the Georgia State Legislature for 10 terms. After his defeat in the 1986 race, he left political life. He now hosts a syndicated TV show and is a visiting professor at Drexel University. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When science fiction writer William Gibson hears the term cyberpunk, he thinks of mohawks and modems. Although he's considered the father of cyberpunk, mohawks and modems are not his style. Coming up, William Gibson talks about taking science fiction in new directions. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new album by a group whose first recording was a surprise hit here in the United States, the Bulgarian State Radio and Television Female Vocal Choir. And urban legends expert Jan-Harald Brunvand explains why some New Zealanders believe that placing a bottle full of water on their lawns will prevent the neighborhood dogs from relieving themselves there. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. George Bush was campaigning in the Midwest today, claiming he holds the mainstream mandate in next week's election. Bush defended his running mate, Dan Quayle, saying Quayle has been through the fire and his head is up and his chin is up. The vice president campaigned through Illinois and Michigan, two key Midwestern battlegrounds. Michael Dukakis attacked George Bush today for refusing to say he had cut off aid for any country that won't cooperate in the war on drugs. More from NPR's Linda Wertheimer.
Michael Dukakis was talking tough in Chicago to a crowd the police estimated at 20,000 people gathered in Daley Plaza in front of City Hall. According to Dukakis, Bush won't promise to disturb international relationships if countries don't cooperate in the war on drugs. I will, Dukakis said. Depend on it.
I'll work with other countries, but I'll be damned if I let those countries send their poison into the United States of America and destroy our kids.
Dukakis promised financial aid and military assistance to countries joining the United States in efforts to stop drug smuggling. But, he said, if you think you can do to Mike Dukakis what Noriega did to George Bush, he went on, you're in for a big surprise. I'm Linda Wertheimer in Chicago.
At the request of the Soviet Union, American and Soviet arms control and radar experts met today in Geneva. The Soviets had said they wanted to talk about the Krasnoyarsk radar installation, which the U.S. claims is illegal under the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. When the session was over, U.S. officials said nothing had been accomplished. Barry Schwide reports.
Senior Soviet negotiator Viktor Karpov had hinted in July the Soviets would be willing to dismantle Krasnoyarsk, which the U.S. says could be part of a national anti-missile defense in violation of the ABM treaty. But U.S. officials said the Soviets did not repeat the offer at the meeting. In fact, State Department spokesman Charles Redmond said the Soviets made no new proposal. As a result, the Reagan administration warned that unless the Soviets destroy Krasnoyarsk, the U.S. might declare the facility a material breach of the 1972 treaty. Under international law, that would be a big first step toward abrogating the treaty, which may be the most significant arms control agreement signed by the superpowers during the detente era of the 1970s. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
With few exceptions, Arab leaders have expressed dismay at the outcome of yesterday's elections in Israel. The results show that Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir of the Likud party has a significant advantage in forming a new government. But as NPR's John Hockenberry reports, the actual government is days or weeks away and will involve some formidable political hurdles.
Under Israeli law, Israel's president will ask the party receiving the most votes in Tuesday's elections to try to form a new government. The Likud party has won 39 seats in the Knesset to the Labor Party's 38 seats, a virtual deadlock. But as has been the case in many Israeli elections, it is the smaller parties which hold the balance. For the first time since 1959, religious parties hold more than 16 seats. Yesterday's polling gave them 18. Their success was a surprise to virtually all observers. Today, Yitzhak Shamir and Foreign Minister Shimon Peres began talks with the religious party leaders on forming a new government. Religious parties are most interested in education and in regulating certain aspects of Israeli society to conform with Jewish law. These issues are controversial, and combined with the new aggressiveness of the religious parties, it could make negotiations difficult. Likud party officials said today that the first talks went well, but deeper waters were up ahead. I'm John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 6 points to close at 2156.83. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. That's the sound of the Bulgarian State Radio and Television Female Vocal Choir. The 26-member group is currently on its first North American tour following the success of their album Le Mystère des Voix Bulgares, The Mystery of Bulgarian Voices. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of their latest recording.
Probably no one was more surprised than Nonesuch Records that one of its best sellers for 1988 was an album of Bulgarian music in its Explorer series. For years, that much-applauded series filled a major recording gap in ethnic music, but I don't think it's ever produced an album that hit the charts. Le Mystère de la Voix Bulgare by the Bulgarian State Radio and Television Female Vocal Choir was already a hot item in England before it was released here. To coincide with its American tour, a second album has just been issued. Le Mystère de la Voix Bulgare Volume 2 consists of material that was recorded in Bulgaria as recently as last year and as long ago as 1957, as in this duet, The Fox Has Lost His Cubs. Nearly half of the cuts were done in the 70s, and some of them with groups and soloists other than the now famous female choir. Though this second collection is also strikingly beautiful, it's at somewhat of a disadvantage for not having been released first. Part of the success of Volume 1 was that it was such a revelation. It introduced a lot of Western ears to those dissonant Eastern European harmonies in pitch-perfect seconds and sevenths, and those extraordinary vibrato-less women's voices, part nasal, part chest voice. You could imagine the wavering tunes of a harvest song, a wedding song, a love song, or a lament, carrying across an open field. That album also established the peculiar genre of folk music not merely transcribed, but artistically arranged and carefully rehearsed by a very impressive professional choir. There are even original compositions. These are concert, not field recordings. So Volume 2 really has to rely more heavily on the material itself for its surprises. And though that material remains wonderfully evocative, I'm not sure how much it adds to what we've already heard. Partly because that first volume was nothing if not wide-ranging. One tune could sound as if it were made for Carmen Miranda, another as if the Cordettes had heard the female choir harmonizing before they recorded Mr. Sandman. Or were members of the choir fans of the Cordettes? Maybe I'd be a lot more receptive to Volume 2 if I knew more specifically what each song was about. I'm not fluent in Bulgarian, and neither volume includes translations, only titles such as Young Childless Wife, I'm Going to Buy You Some White Silk, Confession, or this song, simply called Teasing.
Thank you.
On second thought, maybe we really don't need to know more than the title after all. As before, the performances are astonishing, delivered with a powerful vocal and emotional intensity. When those vibrato-less voices break out into the shakes, it's as if the earth itself is trembling under all of us. Let's close with the most moving song on the second volume, the lament Young Childless Wife. Radka Alexova is the heart-rending soloist with the vocal choir.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. The Bulgarian State Female Vocal Choir will be on tour through November 19th with performances in New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Berkeley, Los Angeles, and Seattle. Their latest album is on the Nonesuch label. This is Fresh Air. In William Gibson's science fiction, the setting is a barren post-World War III world where multinationals have taken the place of political systems. Computer hackers vie for power in a computer-generated zone known as cyberspace. Gibson has consciously put into his science fiction references to rock and roll, consumer culture, and modern art, just the sort of stuff he missed in the science fiction he read growing up. With his first novel, Neuromancer, William Gibson became known as the father of a new wave of science fiction that's been called cyberpunk. William Gibson's new novel is titled Mona Lisa Overdrive, and it's set sometime in the future.
Well, you know, I deliberately hedged on that. I would guess from internal evidence that it's sort of the mid-21st century. So what's that, like 60 years?
Uh-huh.
It's not very far away, but it's not... While there's a convention in science fiction that one is writing about the future, no one can really write about the future, and I think that science fiction novels, by and large, reflect the decade that they were created in. You know, the 50s SF, you look at it, and it's the 50s. And I started doing the kind of work I'm doing because I wanted something that reflected the 70s, and everything I was reading that was being written then seemed to me to reflect the 60s.
Well, now it's the 80s. How are you doing?
Well, I've sort of reached the, in a way, I've reached the limit of the material. Like, things have changed so much. When I wrote Neuromancer, my first novel, it was, I didn't know about AIDS. Nobody had heard of that. I knew vaguely about the greenhouse effect, but I didn't think it was going to be anything to worry about. And nobody had told me that the ozone layer was decaying. So in a sense, my imaginary future is already obsolete. So I'm going to, the next time around, I'm going to have to go back and take all those things into consideration.
Your book is set after the wars. What wars did you envision, and what were they fought over?
Well, that's a very optimistic little piece of trickery on my part, because I wanted to be able to write about a future, and I wanted to be able to say, well, it's there. So I've posited as a sort of piece of background information one very, very brief nuclear exchange that results in the whole world saying, oh, no, we've got to get rid of these things. And then you have a future. But, we should be so lucky, probably.
Multinationals play a pretty important role in your books.
I think I originally may have gotten that from Thomas Pynchon's view of the Royal Dutch Shell Company in Gravity's Rainbow, which is the first time I realized that there were companies that could operate on both sides of the Second World War and merge seamlessly, afterwards. And still, these are entities that are outside national boundaries, and that's always fascinated me. I think multinationals, in a sense, are like more evolved life forms.
Describe your cyberspace matrix.
Oh, that's a tough one on that's a tough one off the page. I've posited a level of technology in which people can experience media a bit more efficiently than we can today, so that rather than having to look at a television set and put on the earphones, you simply plug yourself into something that makes you feel that you are in the environment that the media producer has generated. So taking that as a given, and that's an old idea from science fiction. In the 50s, they called that feelies in science fiction. Taking that as a given, I've coupled that with computer technology to try to imagine a world in which computer operators enter into what I've only ever been able to describe as a consensual hallucination.
You've been credited with revitalizing science fiction. When you started writing, did you think of science fiction as needing revitalizing?
Yeah, well, to answer that in two parts, I've been... I may have been credited with it. Would that it were true. I don't, you know, I wish science fiction, you know, had been revitalized. But I did deliberately set out, in an odd sort of way, I didn't set out to be successful at this. I was with my early short stories in the first book, and in a way I was writing things that I thought would bug the science fiction community to no end. And I thought, well, this book's going to be ignored. Because I was tired of, I don't know, I was tired of unicorn fantasies, and I was tired of this sort of endlessly recycled pseudo-Heinleinian stuff, you know, male power fantasies, and the future is the United States, and you know, the sort of things that are being produced by the writers my friend Bruce Sterling likes to call Reagan youth. So I thought, I'm going to come in here and, you know, do the old, you know, put the double whammy on this stuff. But consequently, I expect it to be roundly ignored.
Well, what's an example of something that you thought would really bug other science fiction writers?
Well, for instance, it's impossible on internal evidence, when you read my novel Neuromancer, to determine whether or not the United States exists as a political entity. And you're aware of large corporations, and people have neighborhoods and teenage street gangs, and there's cities or possibly city-states, and certain cities have merged, you know, Boston, Atlanta, and New York are all part of the same big ugly thing, but you can't tell if the United States exists. And I thought that alone was, that alone was done in deliberate reaction to this overwhelming tendency in American science fiction to see the future as America. And I think at one time the world believed that America was the future, but now the future's gone somewhere else, perhaps to Japan. It's probably on its way to Singapore soon, but I think, you know, I don't think we're it anymore.
You're writing the screenplay for Aliens 3, and you're writing screenplays for a couple of your own short stories.
Yeah.
Are you going to treat technology differently in movies than you do in books once you have the chance to, you know, get people to actually build these things that you've only imagined and described on paper?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think I have basically, you know, for that matter, I'm not really sure how it is I do treat technology, but it's amazing, you know, how quickly this stuff develops. So I met some computer special effects people the last time I was in Hollywood, and they said, oh, we want to do cyberspace for you. This is what it looks like. And they started showing me things on monitor screens that, you know, that I couldn't believe. And I said, you can do it. It's almost here. And they said, oh, yeah, definitely. We're going to be able to do this in a couple of years, but we just want to fake it right now for the movie so we can do it with this.
You've imagined levels of technology that we have not reached yet. Are you a technologically adept person yourself?
No, I'm not. I'm a sort of generalist, and I think that's...
Does that mean you know how to use a toaster? What does that mean, being a
generalist? Well, I know how to use a toaster, and I know how to use a relatively primitive word processor, and I know how to use a telephone, but not the really complicated modern ones. But I don't have any I don't have any specific area of technical expertise, and I think, in fact, the reason I was able to get away with what I did in Neuromancer is that I knew virtually nothing about computers. So I sort of imagined what, not only what computers would be, but I imagined what they are, because I had no hands-on experience. And I did that through some strange process of decoding what I took to be the rather poetic language of the hackers, and words like interface, you know, sort of leaking into, you know, common usage. And you know, that's a lovely word. And I thought, what does that mean? So I make up something.
Do you like words like interface? I mean, a lot of people hate words like that because it's...
Oh, I think it's the cutting edge of language, really. Uh-huh. I mean, it's one of the points in English where language is evolving, and language is constantly changing.
Well, your books have added a word to the language in a way. Your books have been named cyberpunk. What do you think of that new word?
Well, that's one I could have done without, but that's a very mysterious word. We're still trying to find out who introduced it. It definitely wasn't one of the participants in this alleged literary movement or phenomena or whatever it is. But I suppose, in a way, it's reasonably descriptive. Although I don't know what people would think of it when they see it. I mean, if I didn't know what it was supposed to mean, I would think it would mean some guy in a mohawk. It's like modems and mohawks or something. A guy with a mohawk and a Mac 2. And that, I don't know, that wasn't what I had in mind. I just thought, when I started out doing this stuff, I thought I was trying to do what I thought I was being a slightly hipper kind of science fiction.
Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
William Gibson's new novel, Mona Lisa Overdrive, is published by Bantam Books. This is Fresh Air. Let's get a rundown on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
You're covering yesterday's election in Israel.
We are. We should be hearing from Jerusalem what the religious parties who gained seats in yesterday's vote are demanding of the larger parties in order to form a coalition. It's expected they will with the Likud party. We also hear from the leader of the Reform Jewish movement in America, Rabbi Alexander Schindler, about what the rise of Orthodox religious parties in Israel may mean for non-Orthodox Jews in the U.S.
What about the elections on the home front?
On the home front, reports from the Dukakis and Bush campaigns, and also we hear from two economists, Murray Wiedenbaum, Republican, Lester Thoreau, a Democrat, about what the next president is likely to face in the way of economic choices.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our urban legends expert, Jan Harald Brunvand, recently returned from a trip to New Zealand. A couple of weeks ago, he shared some New Zealand versions of popular American legends. Today, he's brought back something new.
During my visit to New Zealand, I came across an interesting article in New Zealand Listener, the weekly television and radio program guide, with a wonderful headline, Law and Order. The article asked whether a bottle filled with water and placed on your lawn will deter passing dogs from leaving a calling card. Sounds ridiculous, right? But this bottle on the lawn tactic is serious stuff down under, having spread swiftly from Australia to New Zealand and become an article of faith in both countries. Sure, I've heard of wearing garlic to ward off vampires or a copper bracelet to relieve arthritis and many other such folk preventives, but why would a water bottle keep dogs from doing their business on the lawn? Yet everywhere I went in New Zealand, I saw bottles of water scattered about on the neatly tended lawns. The bottles were the familiar 1.25-liter plastic soft drink containers. Only clear bottles seemed to be used, though sometimes the paper labels had been left on them. I was told that residents of some of the ritzy suburbs put out water in glass bottles that originally held expensive wines and liqueurs. To me, the water bottle idea seems almost as silly as the method used by some people in the States. If they see a dog coming onto their lawn, they stand near the front window and cross their fingers. Then supposedly the dog will refrain from relieving itself. Oh, but back to the water bottles. In search of the truth, New Zealand Listener sent reporter Dennis Welch out to study the matter. Welch chose the town of Napier on Hawke's Bay on the North Island as the site of his research. The answer to all life's problems can ultimately be found in Napier, he explained, and it also has the best Italian restaurant in the country. I, too, visited Napier. I couldn't find the restaurant, but I saw plenty of water bottles on tidy lawns. Law and order seemed to be a national mania, though perhaps not quite a sign of the uptight, anal, repressive tendencies of small-town New Zealand, as Dennis Welch suggested in his article. The usual reason given for the supposed success of the bottle technique is that a dog will not foul its own drinking water. But dogs, of course, do not drink water out of plastic bottles, so some people who scatter the bottles across their lawns say it's the glitter of the bottle or the dog seeing their own reflection in the water that does the trick. Others claim that the bottles themselves repel dogs, and the water's just there to keep the wind from blowing the bottle off the lawn. I also heard that the message of the water bottles was directed not to the dogs but to the dog owners. I don't want your dog fouling my yard. Another theory was that dogs might mistake the plastic bottles for the droppings of some gigantic beast. Another article on this subject quoted a veterinarian who called it one of the most stupid things I've ever heard. Another vet said he saw one hound present its offering right on top of a bottle. Yet an Australian vet who was questioned insisted that the tactic works if done properly. The full territory has to be enclosed with bottles, he said, and the water must not become stale, so the bottles must be shaken regularly to give off the right vibrations. As I thought about lawn order, I wondered whether the litter of plastic water bottles scattered so liberally about a lawn wouldn't be just as offensive as an occasional doggy dropping. I commented to my wife on the remarkable naivete of New Zealanders. How could anyone think that bottles of water on the lawn would have any power over the neighbor's doggy? And my wife said, "But I'm sure I saw water bottles on lawns in our neighborhood back home." I don't recall ever seeing such a thing, but I have a feeling that my findings on this matter have not ended yet.
Jan Harald Brunvander is a professor of English and folklore at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. In the new film Things Change, stand-up comic Jonathan Katz got the chance to play one of those tacky resort comics he used to love watching as a child. Next time I'll speak with Katz about the new film and his 10-year friendship with its director, David Mamet. Katz and Mamet co-wrote the story for the film House of Games. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews three very different new albums from Anita Baker, The Bangles, and Duran Duran. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Good Mother, starring Diane Keaton, directed by Leonard Nimoy. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Salat, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Becky Thorne. Lisa Bruton directed today's show. Our engineer is Richard Parker. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.